Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First application on the list today is Font Config. The end of the previous episode, I was talking about fonts, and that was because there were something like 37 or 40 font packages that I kind of just skipped over, as one does. And this is Font Config. This one is a little it's an application that is used by X11 to catalog and update and configure how fonts are presented, are rendered. And that includes things like hinting and subpixel, anti-aliasing and all that sort of options that you might have for a font to make it look sharp and evenly spaced and just generally pleasant to the eye. Font config is one method that X11 uses to keep track of that sort of thing. It is not necessarily the only method, it is not the only method that fonts are provided to you on your screen. This is one way X11 keeps track of fonts, but there are other systems at play, depending on what kind of application you're using and what libraries it's dependent upon. But font config, if you look in /etc/fonts/conf.avail, you get to see a lot of configuration files, and these determine what kind of configurations each font has available to it. And there's an interactive side to all of this in the form of user bin fc-something. There's fc-cache, fc-cat, fc-conf list, fc-list, and so on. These are generally ways to query or poke font config. And by poke, I mean fc-scan. You can rescan all of the fonts on your system, exclusive or inclusive, depending on a command option. You can scan either everything on your system and everything within a user directory. So, you know, $home/.fonts or wherever you keep your fonts. I think, where do I keep my fonts? My personal fonts, I mean. I think it is in a folder called .fonts, but I don't believe that actually is where it is. Like, I think it's aliased. That's an alias leading somewhere else, I think. .fonts is, yeah, so it's .local/share/fonts, which I guess is the sort of new-ish location for it, but I was just so used to putting things in .fonts, and I don't know, it just seems .local/share/fonts. It's such a long, a long directory path, and I just couldn't be bothered to remember what it was or to type it out when necessary. So I just have /.fonts. So anyway, fc-scan could look in there, could look in the system level user share fonts directory or whatever it is. It's user share fonts, right? I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah, user share fonts. And then of course there's OTF and TTF and type 1 fonts within subdirectories within that. So fc-scan would prompt font config to scan for fonts. You do not have to prompt it to do that. It is something that happens automatically in the background. Don't know how often. All I know is that when I install a font through the Plasma desktop prompt, when I click on a font file, font config gets updated automatically. I don't have to worry about that. I think generally speaking, that's the expectation and what actually happens. So your occasion to use font config directly, even though there are commands for it, is not very common. I mean, I've used Slackware for, I don't know, a long time, since 12.1 or 2, whatever I say it is. I think it must be 12.1. I'm sure I have this conversation on my podcast way too often. But either way, it's been a long time since 12-ish. Never have I ever had to use FC-anything. I just haven't. Not only that, I've never been compelled to. So not only have I not had to use it, I've just never really felt the need to. That said, there are some interesting things here. I mean, FC-list, if you pipe that to less, you get to see like all the fonts that your font config is aware of, which isn't like, I guess, the worst way to get a list of all of the fonts. Because as I say, the font structure, if you look into where your fonts are kept, it can be a little bit all over the place. I mean, there's subdirectories. I mean, you could do, well, no, you couldn't, I guess. I was going to say you could do like a find for all the TTF files, but I mean, that wouldn't include the OTF files or the PFB files or the OTB file. I don't know what an OTB file is. Oh, it must be open type. I don't know. I'm making stuff up. I was going to say open type bold, but I don't think that's what that is. So yeah, lots of different kinds of file, PCF. Did I say that one already? You know, there are a lot of different formats involved here. So FC-list gives you a pretty well, a very full list of everything that it knows about. If you're looking for something specifically, technically you can use FC-query, although frankly, I was never able to get the FC query to work exactly. Let me try it again. Maybe I did something wrong. I think possibly -i is what I need to do. Only query the face indexed of each file. So I'm going to just do -i0. So FC-query -i0. And then I'll say, let's do bit stream. Can't query face 0 of font file bitstream. Okay, how about font file 1 or index 1? Can't query that. Okay, so no index defined gives me can't query face 4,294,967,295 of font file bitstream. Do I have to give it the full list, maybe? I couldn't, like I say, I couldn't get this to work. Okay, here's one, textgirabonum-regular.ttf, and that is in my .fonts folder. So I'm going to do FC-query and the full path to that. That's what did it. That's interesting. Yeah, this is interesting. This is fun. This is nice. FC query and then the full path to a specific font file gives you the family name, the family language, the style, like regular, bold, italics, style lang, full name, the full given name of the font, slant, weight, width, foundry, the file location, the index, which is what it kept telling me it couldn't read, but that was because I hadn't given it, I just gave it the font name and not the not the path. Outline, scalable, character set, shows you a bunch of hex codes for that, and font version, compatibility, and so on. So that could be really good for, I would imagine, well, certainly just finding out more information about a font, but also about, I wonder now this is fun now, this is open logos, let's see about that one. Not as interesting as I'd hoped. Yeah, just kind of standard kind of information, really. Okay, anyway, yeah, I mean, you know, if you were maybe debugging or wanted to get the size, the sort of a feel for the scope of a language or a font, rather, yeah, kind of interesting. Font version 65536. So yeah, anyway, it's FC query. There's FC cache, FC list, FC cat. FC cat is kind of interesting. That simply concatenates all of the data from the sort of font config database very verbosely into your terminal. It's definitely pipe that one through less. I don't know that that's the best way to look through all that data. I think probably FC-list and then FC-query on the result of your listing is probably the more realistic way to see that data. All right, next up is font to SFNT. SFNT is a file format for fonts, and I know that font foundry uses it. There's a lot of alliteration going on here, and it's completely unintentional, I assure you. It can contain, SFNT, can contain OTF and TTF formats, or wait, is it TTF or type 1? Sorry, it's either, I think it's OpenType and type 1 or something along those lines. And so it is a file format for fonts, and this helps you convert a file to SNFT. Specifically, this is designed to get your, to get like a bitmap SFNT. Did I say that backwards? I don't know. SFNT. Anyway, specifically, it's designed to get a bitmap font into this SFNT wrapper, which presumably you would then maybe bring into another application, I'm imagining, to maybe give it sort of a more modern hinting strategy or something like that. That's just kind of what I'm imagining. I've never used it, never had the need for that. I've never designed a font, so why would I? So yeah, that's font to SFNT. And I guess since we're here, I could quickly also just talk about FS2BDF. That's not next in the list, but it's related enough to feel like it. So FS2BDF copies fonts from an X11 font server to standard output. So you could put it somewhere else. You could pipe it into a file or something like that. On X11, there's a concept of a font server. So X11 can get fonts from a directory on your local host, but it can also get a font from a server, so a TCP over a TCP connection. And so you can define on your system using the environment variable font server, all one string, you can define a remote computer that you would like to use fonts from. I've never done this. Don't know what kind of permissions you would need, but it would be something like TCP/, straight from the man page, x.org:7100. So obviously there'd need to be a firewall rule allowing traffic on 7100. If it's very remote, you'd have to have permissions, to access the files where they're located and so on. But that can be a font server. So font to BDF would sort of go to the font server, locate that font file, and cat it into your terminal. That's what that does. Related to this is FS, no, not FS, well, kind of. I could cover it here. XFS info on Slackware. From the man pages, I gather that on other systems it might just be called FS info, but it is indeed called XFS info, which obviously is not in my list right now. And when I get to it later, maybe I'll by chance remember that I covered it already. But XFS info, if you type it in, will probably tell you that no, there is no font server defined, unless you've done that. But you could you could do xfinfo-server, and then the server name, which would be some kind of TCP/ my home server.local:, whatever port, let's say 7100 just for kicks, and then you could find out information about that server and so on. But that I don't have one defined, so it doesn't do a whole lot. And unless you do, then you're not going to get a whole lot from that either. But XFS info could at least give you some information about your font server. Font2BDF can copy a font file from your font server to your terminal, which you could then pipe to its own file. And then finally, last but not least, there's FSLS fonts, which produces a list. I think that probably stands for font server list fonts. And so you could get a list of the fonts available from your font server with this one command, FSLS fonts. I think that's everything for fonts. And then some, right? Because I mean, one of them is XFS info, so we won't be seeing that in the list until quite a while. The next big chunk of packages, to my mind, is about OpenGL, and they're kind of all they're related. So maybe we should go for a coffee break now, and we'll come back and just immerse ourselves in OpenGL. Yeah, let's do that. Thank you. where to begin with OpenGL. It's kind of a big deal, OpenGL, and it has been evolving for such a long time that it's almost hard to encapsulate at this point, because I mean it is what it is. It's OpenGL, and that was for a very long time like the open source 3D rendering engine, like, or API, I guess, and specification. And it was hugely big deal, and still is, but it's no longer called OpenGL technically. OpenGL has kind of like the term or the name, the brand, I guess, has kind of been deprecated in favor of Vulkan, V-U-L-K-A-N. Both are maintained by the same group. It's the Kronos Group, K-H-R-O-N-O-S, I think it is, Kronos. Yeah, K-H-R-O-N-O-S group, so Kronos.org. And they're doing, I mean, I think almost inarguably an amazing job. I mean, Vulkan is, if you go to Vulkan.org, you can kind of see for yourself. I mean, it's kind of everywhere. The listed platforms, just kind of off the top, would be Linux, Android, Nintendo Switch, Molten VK, don't actually know what that is, and then Windows. So I mean, it's that's, I don't know why they list those specifically, because there's more than that as far as I know, but I guess maybe it says to target a wide variety of devices with the same graphics API, so maybe those platforms are the ones specifically targeted. But I do know that, I mean, it can be on more than those. But anyway, I mean, it's a big deal. It is one of the driving forces of modern graphics, which is huge. I mean, that's a really, really big deal. I mean, it's not by any means the only driving force. You know, there are definitely other players in this arena, but I think that it says a lot that Vulkan is such an important component of modern graphics, and that it is open source. And I think that the two are not unrelated. You can look at a lot of the big developers of modern graphics, like in sort of the very big industries of both Hollywood and video games, which in many ways has merged a lot more than I think anyone expected. You know, I'm talking ILM, Disney, Sony, that sort of core group of I guess innovators, and they're using Vulkan. I mean, like, Vulkan is one of their primary like targets and SDKs, and that's one of the things that they are all contributing to. I'm not saying they don't use other things. You'll see other solutions being used, but Vulkan is a big part of it, and I can't imagine that it's a coincidence that it's open source. You know, I think that's a big part of it, because a lot of these companies, they're doing things that graphic libraries don't expect. I mean, they're literally creating new technology. And so using a graphics library with just access to, you know, API calls or just a bunch of libraries that you're allowed to use, I mean, sometimes for development, that's just not enough, because it's just, you know, if you throw a matrix at that library that library hasn't imagined could exist yet, then that's not going to work. So if you have the source code to the library, then suddenly you can go in and modify the library to account for the thing that you've just invented. So the first thing in the list, I guess, is FreeGLUT. I don't know if that's how you really say it. It's FreeGLUT. The UT stands for Utility Toolkit. So there was a library, I guess. I don't know. Maybe it's not around anymore. It feels like it's not around anymore, or it's not up to date anymore, called GLUT or GLUT, and that was the little library set to help people do things with OpenGL. Apparently that fell out of maintenance, but FreeGLUT picked up where that left off, and today is a sort of a convenience library set for people doing OpenGL development. I'm not clear on whether Free Glut is applicable to Vulkan, or if Vulkan has a bunch of new stuff that Free Glut just wouldn't apply to. I believe it's all interchangeable, but I could be wrong, and I didn't do enough research into Vulkan to determine for sure whether that's true or false. Either way, I mean, the sentiment online seems to be that the more you sort of start with OpenGL and FreeGlut and stuff like that, the better prepared you are for Vulkan anyway. So even if you're not diving straight into Vulkan and you're doing something with OpenGL, then, and I said that twice on purpose, like, you know, because again, Vulkan is just basically, it's just OpenGL, but rebranded and with new stuff. You know, it's the continued maintenance of, or the development of OpenGL. So you're very much just kind of, you're still doing the same thing. It's not an X11 versus Wayland kind of schism, like break. It is very much just, you can develop one and go right into the next one. So FreeGlut, that exists. Where are you gonna see FreeGlut being used? Well, you'll see it being used in development for, or rather, things that use OpenGL. You could see, you might see references to FreeGlut. So you could see, for instance, a hash include gl/freeglut.h in a file that is drawing something to a window that is, you know, an OpenGL rendered window. You'll see freeglut.h being included there so that it can then use all the different functions of OpenGL, or at least all the functions of glut of OpenGL UT. I mean, because interestingly, like, if you're really going down the path of like hand coding OpenGL visuals, then you're going to need more than just FreeGlut. Like, you're going to need GSM for your matrices and things like that. So, matrices and a bunch of advanced mathematics stuff. I think that's what GLM probably stands for. I can find out actually from SPO, from slackbuild.org, because they have a build script for GLM 0.9.9.5 currently at the time of recording. GLM, OpenGL Mathematics. Yeah. So it's header files for mathematics, for GLSL. That's the shading library. Just scanning the description doesn't really mention what kind of mathematics it does, but I do know for a fact that it does matrices. So there is that. And you would need that for your 3D objects. Like you can certainly do some basic OpenGL, programming just with C++ and FreeGlut, no problem. You can do some basic stuff. You can draw like 2D shapes specifically, and you can give them textures and you know, really basic textures. And I think that's probably about all you could do, really. Which may be, I guess, what you'd want to do. I don't know. I don't think you would want to do it that way, to be honest. I don't know why you would be using OpenGL without shaders, like without a dedicated shader library and so on. But you can define, you know, a shape within a 2D space using just normal C++ stuff. 0.0, comma, 0.7, negative 0.7, comma, negative 0.7, 0.7, comma, negative 0.7. Suddenly you have triangle vertices located on a Cartesian grid, and it's in a 2D space, and OpenGL with FreeGlut can understand how, you know, knows that those are points that you want connected and so on. But if you want to do more complex shapes like cubes and spheres and things like that, you'll need GLM. Now, even for a basic 2D shape, you're looking at about 100 lines of code, which, you know, I could go through, but it would be quite boring. So doing it by hand, I mean, I know that it happens, but it's a real job. And I don't know how often it happens with just literally typing out the points that you need. Generally speaking, you're looking at a graphical client that can create these definitions for you and then render them for you and apply your shader files and things like that. But OpenGL, I mean, obviously, because you do need like GLM, for instance. I mean, it's a big system, and for such a big system, you need kind of support libraries, extensions, and then support libraries to manage those extensions for you, which is what GLEW is, which is not immediately the next one in this list because I'm all over the place today, but it's within this block. GLEW, that's the OpenGL Extension Wrangler Library, and it is the thing, it's the component, it is a component that helps kind of manage and load and plug in all of these extensions that come from lots of different sources. Because one of the advantages of OpenGL is that you're not just painting pixels, you're sending math over to a graphics processor to figure out all of these vectors that you're creating. So you've got AMD libraries, you've got NVIDIA libraries, Intel libraries, other libraries that have been created by other groups that might be cross-functional. And some of them, of course, are not cross-functional. They're specific to a platform. And so you sometimes need to be able to determine, ideally, you would be able to determine what that platform, what the platform that's being, that your thing is being compiled on, what does that need? What does that support? So, I don't know. Probably the AMD stuff, let's say, is probably relatively cross-functional. Well, no, I say that. I mean, obviously, if the thing that it's being compiled on is going to be using an NVIDIA GPU, then maybe you don't need to compile in the AMD stuff. I mean, more than likely you would include both because you would want it to be kind of plug and play regardless. But I mean, that would be an option. Certainly the Apple _ those libraries, yeah, probably not as useful on a Windows system or a Linux system. So that kind of detection, that kind of support, GLEW. Then there is GLU, which kind of sounds the same, glue and glue, but it's different. This is the Mesa OpenGL Utility Library, also known as LibGLU, LibGLU. It's because of Mesa that we have that OpenGL is on your system. And I guess you could say in a way that's like truer than you might even realize. I mean, Mesa or LibGLU rather, that's literally the library that makes OpenGL run on your system. But the history of Mesa is really, really fascinating. And there's a great little history lesson on mesa3d.org/history.html. If you read through that, it's just a fascinating story as told by Brian Paul, who is the guy who started the project back in 1993. In August of 93, he says, I began working on Mesa in my spare time. The project has no name at that point. I was simply interested in writing a simple 3D graphics library that used the then new OpenGL API. I was partially inspired by the VOGL library, which emulated a subset of IrisGL. I had been programming with IrisGL since 1991. And then by November 94, Brian Paul contacted SGI to ask permission to distribute OpenGL-like graphics library on the internet. SGI was receptive to the idea, had a little bit of negotiation with their legal department, and he got permission to release it. This is November of 94. So, I mean, looking, just to kind of, like, emphasize, looking at SGI, big name in graphics. Toy Story, pretty major cinema release that kind of was really, in many ways a proof of concept of 3D animation. 1995. So Mesa 94, Toy Story 95. Wouldn't surprise me if there was a little bit of Mesa in Toy Story. I mean, I don't have evidence for that. I don't have like copies of emails or lists of packages installed on the SGI stations, but would not be surprised. And by Mesa in Toy Story, I just mean it was highly likely that it would have been the way to get OpenGL on those workstations, on certain workstations that SGI had yet to support. It's just a theory. I could be wrong. It's neither here nor there, really. It's just kind of trying to underscore here the significance of all of these packages. Like like a lot of times on Linux, you know, it's like, oh, there's this cute little application that I use, and it's really quite good, and it's an alternative to such and such, maybe, which, you know, I dislike that turn of phrase, but it's nevertheless kind of, a lot of times that's kind of how we think about things. But I mean, in graphics, truly for open source, like many of the most significant advancements in graphics are being made, maybe not daily, I don't know how you want to count it, monthly, yearly, on open source. It's that's just how it is. Not all the time, and there are, you know, plenty of houses, studios out there that are just using off the shelf things. They're not doing any R&D. They're not doing their own, you know, they're not modifying libraries and so on. But the big heavy hitters, they're most certainly doing exactly that. They're taking these libraries that you and I are just running in the background because, you know, it makes pictures look good on our computer screen, and they're modifying them, they're updating them, they're changing them, they're making it possible to render hundreds and hundreds of unique little nodes of models on screen at one time, and, you know, the stuff that you see in the movies and in the video games, like, a lot of that is, like, the new stuff, the stuff that people are winning the science awards at the Oscars, whatever those that one division of awards is called. They're building this stuff on open source. Their products might not be open source. They might not be releasing the thing that they have created as open source. But I mean, the libraries and things that make them possible are open source. And that's just exciting. That's just cool. It's nice to see these things being used earnestly for things that we can all enjoy. Most of us can enjoy. I guess you need the money to go to the cinema. But I think things tend to get around eventually. And I feel in some ways, and you know, there might be a counterpoint to this, but in some ways I kind of feel like some of these things are kind of how open source is supposed to function. Not exactly, because I mean, there's definitely room for improvements trickling down better than they do, but I feel like with graphics, you do see the improvements kind of ripple throughout a lot of things where they don't necessarily have to. And I mean, and you just, all you have to do is compare that, you know, compare the advancements made on the open source graphic libraries with advancements made over on Unreal Engine or, you know, DirectX or whatever. And you don't see improvements from those camps. You see copycat improvements. Like once one person figures out how to do it on their platform, then everyone else figures out how to do it on theirs. That's pretty standard for technology. I think it's kind of the poor man's open source. It's just kind of like, well, we're gonna re-implement that now. But isn't it nicer when you actually have the source code and you don't have to re-implement, you just get it for free? Yes, it is a lot nicer. All right, next up is GCC MakeDep. This is one of those applications that I, on one hand, I wish I'd known about ages ago. So I'm going to just go into a test demo directory here and make a little test.cpp file. I'm just going to do hash include greater than less than io stream greater than symbol using namespace std semicolon int main parentheses curly brace standard :: c out redirect or, you know, less than hello world close quote semicolon return 0 semicolon curly brace. Pretty simple little application, pretty darn useless, but it uses, it references IO stream. So if we do g++ test.cpp, we get an output file called a out. And if we execute it, it does exactly what you would expect. It prints hello world. And what does it depend on? IO stream. Yeah, but what does it really depend on? And that's the thing. So I'm going to do GCC make dep, yep. And then I'm going to do dash F make file. I don't exactly know why that's the default, to be honest, but that's the default, dash F make file. And then, I mean, no, it's not. It's that's not the default. You have to define your file. I think if you don't, it just puts it into make file. It's weird. GCC make dep dash F make file. And then the source document itself is test.cpp. Okay, so it says line 118 make file, no such file, or 110, no file or directory, cannot stat make file. Okay, whatever. I guess I didn't need the dash F make file. But now there is a make file, is my point. It did not just make a make, I mean, it did just make a make file. It didn't just make like a completely perfectly working make file, but it has made a make file that produces your object file, test.o, and it tells you exactly what that is going to depend on. Like, as compiled, like, these are the files, the libraries and the header files and all that other good stuff that this requires. And I mean, that's 128 lines of text, amazingly. And all I did was include IOStream, but there's all that other stuff. You know, there's like, where's something that's short enough to read it out? Here's one. User include C++ 11.2.0/bits/memory /forward.h. Like, you don't really think about that particular header file when you're just compiling something with in C++, because you don't have to. You don't have to know that that exists or that you needed that for C++ to operate. And there's more. It's not just everything in the C++ directory. I mean, there's other stuff. User include pthread.h. User include sketch.h. And so on. So it's, I don't know how, you know, exactly useful it is. I do feel like at some time in the past, though, I have thought I just want to know what this thing actually needs. Like, am I missing anything? Am I forgetting about anything? And this will give you the full list, as you can see, 128 lines of header files that are required for, and others. I mean, it's not just header files. That are required for this thing to actually compile and run. Really, really cool command. And apparently it's just kind of part of X11. It's like a utility that the X11 developers must use, I guess. And so it's in there. You get it for free, along with the rest of, you know, the part that you actually care about, which is so cool. I love that. Okay, next up is hack fonts TTF. This is just another font file that doesn't start with the word font, so it's organized separate from all the other fonts that I skipped over previously. I'm going to skip over this one too. It's a typeface. It's a typeface for writing source code. I mean, obviously you don't need hack fonts to write source code, but it's designed to be, I guess, you know, nice for source code. And apparently it expands on contributions of Bitstream Vera and Deja Vu projects. It includes monospace, regular, bold, oblique, and bold oblique sets so that you get a bunch of different options for your syntax highlighting. Seems useful. Seems nice. I like that. I mean, I'm not using it, interestingly, but I don't even know what font I am using these days in my terminal, to be honest. I have no idea. Maybe I'll try hack fonts for a while. Just see how it treats me. Could be fun. Or maybe I'll use that in Emacs or something. I don't know. We'll see. And the next one is iBus. And this is one of those that has a bunch of packages that are related to iBus. This is an input method, so it's a little bit within the camp of FCITX, which I covered in the previous episode. The process is pretty similar to FCITX in a way. This one I did on XFCE just for kicks, just to see how the process might be a little bit different. It really wasn't, to be honest. I mean, luckily with a lot of that stuff on Linux, the desktop, having different desktops, a lot of them have converged to, or not converged, but conformed, I guess, to enough free desktop standards that it doesn't really matter in the end. I mean, you might be clicking maybe a different button or something, but not really. So yeah, it's really, really smooth. So iBus, you got it already. So what you need to do is go to IBUS dash, what is it, setup. Instead of, remember FCITX was like FCITX dash config tool or something like that. This is IBUS dash setup. I think it was config tool. Am I thinking of something else? Either way. Oh, I'm thinking of, no, config tool for FCITX. Probably. I don't know. Doesn't matter. IBUS dash setup. IBUS is different from DBUS. It's important to remember. But IBUS dash setup. And then it warns you that the daemon isn't running and do you want to start it. So in this case, I'll say yes, because I do want to start it, because otherwise I can't access the setup step. Then it very helpfully warns you that in order that IBUS has started, but in order to use it properly, you have to add these lines to your .bashrc. Now recall, for FCITX, I had you add lines to your .bash_profile. And I said specifically .bash_profile for reasons. And I couldn't remember the reasons, but I just knew that if you did it there, then it worked. Well, this one says .bashrc. I didn't second guess it. I just did what it said. I removed my my .bash_profile so that I'm not telling it two different things, because these lines are very, very, well, some of them they're setting the same variable. So if you were stepping through FCITX, then .bashprofile needs to be moved to a .bash_profile dash, holding or staging or old or, something, or just remove it, whatever you want to do. And then export gtk_im_module equals IBUS. And that's, again, gtk_im as an input method _module equals IBUS. And the gtk_im_module are all caps. And then export qt_im_module equals IBUS. And again, probably, in this particular case, I'm using XFCE, so I probably don't really need to set qt im method, except that we all use a little bit of each, probably, so you probably ought to go ahead and set them both. And then a new one that I didn't know about, and this might work for FCITX as well, I don't know, didn't notice that I didn't have it, but you can do export space X modifiers, again, all capitals, just X modifiers, equals at, the at symbol, im equals IBUS. That's a weird one. I didn't look into it. I don't know why it's so weird. I don't know what it does. I just followed instructions and put that into .bashrc. Okay, so then the setup starts, or the preferences window launches. And you can kind of leave everything in the general tab as is. That sets your super space, the Windows key or the Cooler Master key or the Tux key, whatever special key you have on your keyboard, the super button. Press that in the space bar and you'll switch your input method. I don't like that. I got used to super space being like kind of Alt F2, essentially, from my old Mac OS days, when Superspace brought up Quicksilver, or as Spotlight, or whatever they called it, but I used to use Quicksilver. So general tab, you could change it, you could leave it, whatever. Input method is where you set what kind of input methods you want available to you. I put in English, Dvorak, because that's what I use. I put in Chinese, Pinyin, because that's not what I use, but it's a thing that I know should work based on FCITX. And then I put in Esperanto, and I, for the life of me, couldn't figure out the scheme for Esperanto. So Pinyin is the one that's sort of, it seems full-featured and very sort of easy to figure out. I don't know what it is about the other options, but they're just not always making a whole lot of sense to me. So there's also a tab, so that's input method. There's also a tab called emoji, and this is kind of an interesting one as well. And I'm bringing it up because there's a specific package about IBUS emoji, I think, isn't there? Or did I just make that up on the spot? I feel like that's the reason I started down that path. No, I made that up. Okay, so I guess I got down this path because there's a tab dedicated to it. So if you click on emoji, you'll see that the keyboard shortcut for an emoji is control dot, or control period, or control full stop, whatever you call that dot-like character. Control dot brings up an emoji Or it puts you into emoji mode, and I'll talk about that in a little while because it's a little bit different than everything else. And then there's an advanced tab, which I ignored. So yeah, that's kind of it. That's the setup. And now that you have set things up and added input methods in your system tray, wherever that might be on your system, in this XFCE install, it's up at the top right. In your system tray, you now have a little input method selector. Click on that, you'll see whatever you have. I have English, Esperanto, and Chinese. So I'll switch over to Chinese, and I'll start typing. Is that working? No. Oh, this is because I didn't switch over. There we go. And I start typing, and then the little pop-up menu comes up that shows me all my different options. And I can type a number to select which, sort of auto completion, as it were, I want to use. And yeah, that works as expected. So I'm typing in pinyin, and who knows what I am actually typing. Okay, I'm going to switch back. Actually, I'm going to switch to Esperanto really quick. Esperanto doesn't really have, like, its own characters. It does have little macrons over some of the characters, and I'm wondering now if there's anything that I've missed. No, there really isn't. Yeah, I don't know how to, and I don't know where to find the documentation on how to make it meaningful. Yeah, I don't know. Interesting. I don't know why that's an option. Okay, so that's a bust, but the pinyin one worked, and then I'll switch back to English to be able to just type normal, and that works. Okay, so because iBus is running, I have my input methods. Well, I can ignore the input methods. No matter where you are, if you click or if you type control dot, for whatever reason, it starts with an E, an underlined E. I don't know why that is. It's weird. Maybe it stands for emoji. But then you could type in, for instance, smile. No, that didn't work. Okay. Control dot. There we go. Smile. Oh, return. No. Control dot. I swear this worked. Oh, yeah. Space. Okay. So control dot and then the space. And then you hit space and it brings up a selector with lots of different categories. Favorites, activities, animals and nature, flags, food and drink, objects, smileys and people, symbols, travel and places, open Unicode choice. So I'll go to food and there's a lot of blank spaces here. Like way more blank spaces than I would have expected. So what you need for full emoji support is you need to go to the internet and find an emoji font that you like. I know that I don't know for sure, but Noto emoji font from Google seems to be pretty good. It seems like there's a lot of emoji symbols there, and you can set the Unicode font you want to use in iBus-setup in the emoji tab. There's font and style, and you can go to Unicode font, Noto, color, emoji, regular, or whatever emoji font you decided to download. I know there are probably quite a few of them. And with that installed, you can now type fancy emoji, at least in theory. So I'm going to do control dot again, space, to get my little chooser, coffee. And I've still got no glyphs in my little auto chooser, my iBus-UI-emoji or whatever it's called. And this is weird. And I think that the problem is that I'm not setting the font for the little dialog box that chooses emoji. I'm choosing the emoji font that gets rendered after I have selected the emoji, but in terms of seeing the image that I am about to insert into in place of what I'm typing, doesn't seem to be working. Except, I mean, it does. So the character is rendered. So in other words, I'll type. And actually, in the terminal, in XFCE terminal, anyway, it's not working. So I'm gonna just quit that for now. So my process, I'm going to open up a web browser just so I have something else to type into other than a terminal. So control dot and then space to get my little chooser. Type in the word coffee. I certificate, a blank box, but it seems to really like that blank box. It has that highlighted, and the description for the blank box is hot beverage, annotations drink, tea, steaming hot coffee beverage, hot beverage. Code point is U plus something. It doesn't say, actually. So I'm just going to click on this highlighted box. And now in my URL bar where I started typing in Firefox appears a coffee emoji. So it is, and I'll try it again, control dot space penguin. Again, blank box, but the description matches what I just typed. It is, again, I can't see the full Unicode point, U plus space space F maybe or something. I don't know. So I'll click on that and there's a little penguin emoji. So the results are correct. It is rendering the desired Unicode character, the emoji, in the desired font, but the process of choosing it is admittedly not really working. I looked up a couple of places, so the entity that pops up so that you can choose your emoji, you can trigger this by ibus space emoji space utility, which I think is really a fancy way of expressing ibus dash, what is it, ibus dash emoji, maybe it's just, nope, emojier, nope, I don't know what it is, ibus. I do man ibus space emoji space, what was it, utility, then I get, yeah, ibus dash emoji. Okay, I don't know why that didn't come up earlier, but okay, so ibus dash emoji is the application, and that is located in /usr/libexec/ibus-ui-emojier, that's emojier. And this is the GUI to select an emoji by typing an emoji annotation or choosing a character with mouse clicks. It's designed to work as an extended ibus lookup window using space, enter, and arrow keys. So that this should work. And there is a font variable that you can set, apparently, but it also says just choose that font with ibus dash setup and select something like Noto Color Emoji or Android Emoji. And well, I've installed Noto Color Emoji regular, so that should be functioning, and that is the one selected in ibus dash setup, so that should be working, but that doesn't seem to be affecting the emojier itself. So I'm going to, one last ditch effort here, I'm going to close that window, I'm going to log out and get return to SDDM, log back in, and this is just sort of on the off chance that, oh, now it's not, what am I doing wrong here? Oh, there we go. Okay. I was just mistyping my fake password. This is my virtual machine. So, okay. So let's see, go here, go there. Let's get back to a terminal. I don't think my ibus daemon is working now. So I'm going to type in, ibus dash auto start, which obviously you could put into your dot bash RC or something like that. Now I've got my selector. Doesn't really matter. I just needed the ibus daemon to be running. And now I'm going to do a control dot space. Start typing in coffee again. Yep, blank looking selectors. So yeah, really not working all that well in the emoji, like the UI component of the emoji selector, which is weird. You'd think of all the applications that would just default to the emoji font as available, you'd think that would be the thing. But there doesn't seem to be a way to influence that. I can show emoji variants or close that window. That's the only options I get for the ibus dash emoji entity. I can launch it from the terminal with that ibus dash emoji utility, and that's it. I cannot figure out how to configure this thing beyond just setting things in ibus dash setup, and that doesn't seem to influence that little widget. So not entirely successful for the emoji part of ibus, but everything else works exactly as you would expect. You choose your input method, and then you have access to all manner of variant or alternate alphabets. And it works really well. And I'm imagining that it would work, you know, be very useful for anyone not using the Roman alphabet for their language. I think that's about it for this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep the source open.
Turn out exactly as we wanted.